Yogami, a podcast from Miami about yoga and stuff. Okay, and welcome everyone to our third episode of Yogami. This is a podcast from Miami, specifically from Miami Shores, focusing on yoga and stuff. And this is our third episode. We're really excited about this episode. To begin with, I'm Vicente, and I'm here with my lovely co-host,
Anna Margaret.
And this is an episode we've been really looking forward to, not only because our guest has one of the world's great radio voices, but the topic is meditation, of course, as it relates to yoga, but even more specifically, meditation in the workplace. And this is a topic that is getting more and more press because many companies are using not only yoga, but specifically meditation for very specific purposes, opening up programs, meditation programs, and meditation options for their employees. I was just reading today of the CEO of Aetna, the huge insurance giant that
Absolutely.
Practices meditation and has incorporated it to actually change the culture of the whole company,
Correct.
From what I was reading. So this is a timely topic, and we look forward to discussing it for a while, a relaxed while with Fred. And one of the great things about Fred that makes this such a special occasion for us is, of course, that we're all sort of interrelated through places where we study yoga, and in particular, Anna Margaret has a long history with Fred. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I do. I'm so happy to have Fred Tan here. Hi, darling. And Fred has played many roles in my life. He's been a friend, or he is a friend, has been a student. We've been partners in crime and opened a yoga studio together. And just continue to create ideas and dreams, and slowly they start to manifest. So welcome to our show.
Thank you.
We've wanted you here for a long time.
I appreciate it.
So one of the things, I guess the first thing we'd like to know is, how did you come to meditation and, you know, and teaching people? Because you are a full-time job.
Correct.
So just like how did that magic happen?
So I started meditating, or actually I started inquiring about forms of meditation when I lived up in New York. This is now in the 90s, the mid-90s. I graduated from business school and found myself really stressed out, like so many New Yorkers are. Mm-hmm. And I was on a trading desk, and I found that I really couldn't manage my anxieties and the stress that I was feeling from work. So in going out and finding out what modalities and what I could do beyond going to the gym, I encountered meditation. That whole process, and I tried a variety of forms of meditation, but what it led me to is my first and current yoga teacher, outside of yourself, Anna Margaret.
There's someone else.
There is someone else. Our joint teacher, Rod Stryker. I discovered Rod from a yoga journal conference that was being held in New York. And through studying with him, it took me deeper into the yoga practice. Mm-hmm. And then when I got down here in Miami, as you know, Rod had strongly suggested that I study with you, and the rest is history.
Yeah, when a teacher strongly suggests, and I'm doing air quotes, that means do it.
Exactly.
Well, also I know that obviously through Rod you share a particular tradition. Can you tell us about that tradition, and maybe to give us a general context, how that tradition might be different in terms of its meditation practices from other approaches?
Great question. That's right. We're, Anna Margaret and I are a part of the Himalayan tradition, and it's a tantric tradition, but it mixes tantra with classical yoga with Vedanta philosophically. So it's a merging of various schools, if you will, and it's a living tradition. So Anna Margaret and I were just commenting before the program started that many people don't realize that yoga emanates from living traditions that have been passed down, and our specific lineage is more than 5,000 years old, and it was brought to this country by a master called Swami Rama. And the seat of our tradition here in the States is in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. So these are teachings that have been passed down orally from teacher to teacher to teacher, and there's a whole initiation that you go through the process of learning, and that truly enlivens what we learn and how we can apply it to our lives.
You know, people sometimes are like, oh, why should I meditate, and like, what benefits am I going to get, and it's hard for me to sit still, blah blah. So I know we're going to develop especially some of the techniques that we can do, but what are some of the benefits of having a personal meditation practice?
Well, it's wonderful now, and Vincente just mentioned that he had read about Aetna applying it, and we'll go there in a second, mm-hmm. in terms of its corporate applications, because you're absolutely right, it is just exploding now. But meditation, there's so many studies now that have been done around the benefits of meditation, and so no longer is there a doubt as to the benefits that it has, and it ranges from reducing body pain physically, to boosting the immune system, to lowering blood pressure, to easing inflammation, reducing heart risk. From a mental perspective, it not only allows us to focus more and improves our ability to become aware of our surroundings and our own feelings and emotions and thoughts, but it also increases over time our gray matter. It builds focus and meditation, and it cultivates more willpower over time. So as we're meditating, we're developing very gradually all of these abilities that allow us to live and to interact with the world in a much more empowered state. There's tons of the Jon Kabat-Zinn's tradition around mindfulness, mm-hmm. Has done a tremendous job in bringing, in secularizing, in fact, yeah. meditation, and bring it out. And in fact, a lot of what we're seeing in corporate America, mm-hmm. in terms of their acceptance of meditation, comes from Jon Kabat-Zinn's and University of Massachusetts and the Center for Mindfulness's development of meditation. And one of the reasons that it has been so powerful, the movement, is that not only have they integrated a lot of evidence-based research behind it that corroborates it, but they've taken out all of the references to religion or spirituality, and it has appealed, therefore, to mainstream America much more.
Sure. Well, actually, that brings me up to a point I wanted to get to, which is the general misconceptions that people have about meditation. One of the reasons I asked is just this morning, mm-hmm. I was reading how, I think it's the Anglican Church, I'm not sure, in Australia, is now trying to eliminate yoga from being practiced in Anglican churches. I want to say it's in Anglican, I'm pretty sure it's Anglican churches, because I think someone heard someone saying a mantra or something.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
And, you know, I think, and in the article, you know, there were various viewpoints, but the person who is sort of the coordinator of those programs is saying, you know, this isn't necessarily a religious practice at all. And it's being misconstrued that way. And do you think generally there's that, those kinds of assumptions get bundled up with meditation?
100%. I think that, again, recently in the last 10 years, we've seen people, mainstream America, and people who aren't familiar with meditation and mindfulness understand that you don't have to be a part of a specific religious or spiritual group to embrace meditation and its practice. But still, there's a lot that needs to be achieved in terms of educating people, mm-hmm. that one does not necessarily correlate to the other. I've been introducing some mindfulness practice specifically in my own workplace, in my mm-hmm. own office, and I've been hosting a lot of seminars and conferences at the firm that I work with, and it has been widely received. And these are people who maybe one or two may practice yoga and understand some of its origins, mm-hmm. But the vast majority have no background in it, and I just approach it as a way of relaxing them and reducing their stress, and it's widely received.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess to be fair also, at least, you know, for a long time when we thought of meditation, we thought of it from an Eastern perspective, so it's like Buddhist meditation, or you had to go to India and you learned meditation and stuff.
Yes.
And now it is becoming more commonplace. So people are just trying to understand where mm-hmm. they fit into this and through their own religion or beliefs. And if they don't have them, can they still meditate?
Gotcha.
And I found that a lot of, there's like these kind of secular meditation places that are popping up that start in LA. Mm-hmm. And you just go in, there's like nothing on the wall, it's completely blank, and you have like 20 minute meditation or 30, mm-hmm. and they're just really trying to introduce it to the mainstream person that would be afraid, or would they would think that they'd have to learn a mantra, or they'd
right.
have to like change their religion to be able to be quiet. But mm-hmm. I think one of the key words that you just said, and maybe this is what's appealing to people, is mindfulness.
Correct.
So kind of using that as just, you know, going inwards and really mm-hmm. watching your own mind and being with that.
Absolutely. That's okay. Exactly what I've been experiencing. I mean, you mentioned Aetna, Vicente, Google, Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. So many well-known firms are starting to embrace it and incorporating a mindfulness program, Humana. All of these companies are even starting to devote a space where people can go and just meditate during the day and then go back to their work. So I equate what's going on, and I like to make a distinction actually between meditation and mindfulness, because the mindfulness is the secularized, what mm-hmm. I define as more the secularized mm-hmm. movement of meditation. All obviously for those of us who have studied mindfulness and meditation, clearly it has origins in Buddhism, but the reality is that it is really distilled. Whereas meditation, for me, encompasses the entirety of mindfulness is incorporated within meditation, mm-hmm. and meditation for me encompasses all of the different traditions, whether secular or non-secular. But it's fascinating to see the wave. If you go on LinkedIn, for example, you can find mindfulness teachers all over the world.
Really?
And you can see conferences, mm-hmm. you can see how it's really gaining tremendous momentum. Mm-hmm. And I equate the movement that's going on now around mindfulness to what went on with yoga 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It really is starting to hit mainstream to the point now that yoga no longer is perceived as that esoteric practice that only people who went to India mm-hmm. would be able to enjoy or appreciate.
Well, I know there's even meditation apps, and you can kind of connect with people all over the world.
Correct.
After you're done with the app.
So, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. I haven't seen
yes,
that.
Yes, it's like, oh, I did it for
Calm.
15 or whatever.
Wow.
And, yeah.
That's right. Calm, Buddhify, tons of apps are coming out now. Right. They're wonderful.
So on that note, I was wondering, is there any benefit to meditating alone or meditating in a group, or what do you think about that?
I think you can get benefits from all sorts. It's just a matter of exploring, experiencing, and seeing what resonates with oneself. Mm-hmm. I've gotten to the point, obviously, myself, where I enjoy my own sitting practice, and that roots me in my everyday. Having said that, I also enjoy group meditation because it's very palpable, the energy and the breathing and how the energy transforms and magnifies with other people in the room. So you can actually get sometimes into deeper states of meditation if and when the group starts really relaxing and easing into the practice. Mm-hmm. So everything has its own benefits, and I would encourage everybody to just explore what works for them. Mm-hmm. Some people enjoy walking mindfulness or walking meditation, which is absolutely fine. Whatever it is that allows us to get to a present moment state where we feel at peace, that is a valid form of meditation.
Along those lines, Fred, I know, you both mentioned, of course, that you're initiates in the Himalayan tradition, and just returning briefly before we focus on the workplace per se, can you speak a little bit about the relationship between meditation and yoga? Because I think that's one of the issues that people don't necessarily understand or try to get their heads around. And also in the United States, of course, yoga has been, in some cases, reduced to a system of physical exercises.
That's
correct. Can you provide people a little bit of context for understanding that relationship?
Sure. So classical yoga, as taught by Patanjali, was prepared us for meditation. Everything we know yoga practice as what we call as asana, the postures, the movements, the transitions, the pranayama, the breathing that we incorporate into the asanas. But all of that ultimately in classical yoga was to prepare us for our sitting meditation, our sitting practice. If you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. To relax the mind, we first have to relax the body. And as our teachers teach us, the breath is the bridge between the body and the mind. So incorporating what we call pranayama or breath work into our yogic practice in order to prepare us to sit makes a lot of sense.
Awesome. Just one more thing, because I'm excited to get to meditation at the workplace. But you brought up how you're able to sit with yourself right now. And I remember one of our teachers that we actually also share as Manorma was learning the difference between being alone and lonely.
Mm.
Right. And when you do have that kind of meditation practice and you can sit by yourself, there's that, that place inside of you that you can always connect with, that you know that you're never alone.
Absolutely.
Right, as opposed to lonely.
I think that's a great distinction, Anna Margaret. Part of the benefit and the appeal of meditation is that you can always tap into your own essence and your own self.
Mm-hmm.
And in that space, there you don't feel lonely.
Mm-hmm.
You can be alone and feel completely in tune with the world, and that is part of where one's peace comes from.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Well, that's great. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll continue with this discussion of meditation, and actually segueing into a discussion or a focus on its uses in the workplace.
Yogami.
And welcome back to Yogami, a podcast from Miami about yoga and stuff. And we're here having a great time with Fred Tran on discussing the relationship between meditation and the workplace. We've been having a general discussion about meditation, and now we're going to segue to more of a focus on the workplace and maybe, you know, what might distinguish meditation in the workplace, its applications in the workplace from, say, what we've just been talking about, the general sort of approach or broader, maybe, I don't want to say deeper approach, but the broader, more contextualized approach to meditation. Maybe one way to approach that is some examples of how you've used meditation for those uses.
So I've incorporated meditation into my own daily life at work, first and foremost by not only developing a focus on what I'm doing in order to create higher impact and higher productivity, but also to work on the awareness that I constantly have, both within myself as well as in relation to my environment, my work environment. So how that might play out is that every morning, whenever I have the ability, I'll center myself before actually starting the day and just engaging in my routine. I'll do a very quick 5-minute practice right at my desk. That's very easy. And then it settles me in and my energies into my workspace. It allows me to get out of my mental state completely and then incorporate it with kind of my heart state and then my intuitive state, so that there is a kind of a more robust tools that I can access with regards to how I approach my day. So that would be one way that I would share how I incorporate a small meditation into my daily. The other is going into meetings where we know they're very they're very focused, they're time constraints, there are a lot of energies in the room, there are a lot of people with different agendas, and so I find that as a form of meditation, doing some breathing practices, breath work, helps me again get into that centered state, and again not be so mental so that I'm just linear, but rather allows me to incorporate awareness into how I approach every meeting and how I address every person in the room.
That's wonderful.
I love that. Yeah. I love that you said the heart and intuition. You know, it gives you an access to both the physical, you know, what's happening there, and also, because like whenever we teach, we also talk about how we see, you know, with the heart as well as the eyes. So it's like in a business like that too, that you have to kind of sit there and be open to people that are under you and over you, and how to kind of balance, you know, balance that. Why do you think a company would want their employees to meditate?
Well, Vicenta had mentioned early on in the program about the CEO of Aetna. So that's a beautiful example, by the way, because he really is, he's pioneered to a great degree the use of an adaptation of mindfulness into the workplace. So what Aetna did is that it took around 300 and so of its own employees and did a trial program and developed a whole mindfulness program based on the mindfulness based reduction an MBSR, which is the program that had been developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn and the Center for Mindfulness up in Massachusetts. And what was established, and they tracked people's productivity, their tardiness, their absenteeism, and also their health. And what they found is for every dollar that they spent on the program, $8 in increased productivity or in reduced healthcare costs combined mm-hmm. was achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So now corporate America had a statistic that it could fall back on that was empirical, that was data that said, wow, this is the benefit of a mindfulness program. And that's what actually has, to a great degree, led to all these other companies saying, we want that too, mm-hmm. because as we know, healthcare costs are going off the roof.
Yeah.
So it's a very compelling story. And again, more and more of this data is being developed by the same corporations that are offering it to their employees.
Wow, that's excellent. I mean, that really gets to the core of why companies would rush, right?
Well, a dollar sign is it's like the binder, like, okay,
that's
there
right.
it is.
That's right. It's really wonderful to see this intersection between, mm-hmm. you know, data, evidence-based data, and, you know, what the yogis have always known, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
It's wonderful to see it manifest.
So the flip side, of course, is what employees might get out of this. And the reason I ask that, of course, is because I've gotten the sense, like even here at Berry, there's this effort to try to provide employees a lot of options to improve their health generally. And sometimes those kinds of things are met with suspicion,
mm-hmm.
right? That there's an effort to intrude into people's lives mm-hmm. For the sake of saving a few dollars.
It's a great question, Vicenta. So for the individual, the benefit absolutely has been all about healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the concrete statistics, but there are statistics that show that obesity has been addressed, addictions, tobacco cessation. Mm-hmm. There are very, very diabetes have been mitigated. So there are very clear studies that show that of these employees, they can actually improve their health and mm-hmm. mitigate the symptoms that they may have, medical symptoms, through this work. Now again, I don't have those facts, but I would refer anybody who's interested to the National Institute of Health, NIH. Mm-hmm. The NIH on their database now has all this research that they actually in fact have been participated in as well, mm-hmm. showing what are the medical effects for individuals who practice on a routine basis. Even in addiction recovery, mm-hmm. they use it, and they show with some efficacy over time that there is reduced relapse into addiction. So it covers a broad spectrum.
You mentioned that you've led some seminars.
Correct.
Programs. Yeah. So let me just, I'm curious how, like what kind of challenges teaching in a workplace like have come up for you?
Well, the seminars that I've led are of two types, really. One is I asked all of my office mates whether they would like me to conduct every now and then a mindfulness practice in the morning, and they have really enjoyed it. At one point, in fact, the CEO of our company in Boston dialed in to participate in one of these
wow.
sessions when he found out that I was conducting it, and probably it was just to also find out, you know, whether I was
doing
it in a secular way or non-secular
yeah,
way.
Right.
Probably is a part of diligence, but the reality was that he really enjoyed it and he got a lot out of it, and so my peers really enjoy it. That we do it every so often. It's not on a program basis, mm-hmm. And it's really just to increase their awareness of how their state of mind and being can change. And they have approached me later. Many people have approached me and said, you know, I suffered some anxiety just starting the practice, but what I found later is that the benefits really endured throughout the day. So they felt far more calm and far more relaxed and capable of dealing with the stress and the workload throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So it was that's one form of practice that I've conducted. The other form is just to increase the awareness around it. I have invited a person who teaches mindfulness in corporate America to come in and speak as an authority on this. And I've hosted a number of conferences for our own clients, for professionals in our community, just to build the awareness. And so it's been, again, received in such a positive way by people, and they really appreciate learning more about the true benefits of it. And then we'll do, as you've taught me, Anna Margaret, we'll do a practice so that it doesn't stay in the realm of theory.
Yeah.
And data, right? We get out of our minds again and we go into our heart and our breath and our intuition, and we'll do a practice. And so people can feel and experience it.
Now, in terms of these kinds of sessions that you're describing, to feel a benefit, what kind of commitment do you think is required on the part of the person? It's not something at the level of a daily practice, is it? Or
no, you know, I always suggest to people go at their own pace. Everybody's life and life demands are different. What I would say is, start small and build on it. And if that means just starting with breathing deeply, you know, that's a form of meditation, just bringing awareness to your breath. So what we learn in yoga and ultimately in meditation is that we, in the Western culture, breathe from our chest. It's a flight or fight type of breathing, as opposed to diaphragmatic breathing, which is much more deep breathing and conscious breathing. So if you just start with being aware of your breath, it's already can induce a meditative state, a calm state.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be as simple as that, Vicenta. Two, if you feel that you can meditate or sit for, you know, 5 minutes a couple of times a week, wonderful. So you gradually build on it. But I approached meditation like it was something to conquer when I started it, right? So
yeah.
Very type A, you know,
right.
You needed to achieve this, and there was a goal.
And we had Excel sheets.
And we had Excel sheets.
Really?
Exactly.
I did this many times,
exactly.
This long.
Exactly.
Okay.
Very disciplined. And you know, what I learned subsequently is that there's a completely different way. You can enjoy life, or you can...
Serenity now.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So there's a fun way of approaching it. And that's one of the misnomers of meditation, mm-hmm. I think, is that it needs to be so serious and dense, and no.
I love what you said, to start simple and build, because one of the ways that I found that I started wanting to sit as not a chore, but as a pleasure and as a desire, was, you know, I started smalls. Well, no, I started like crazy. Then, like, I fell off the meditation wagon for a while. And when I got back on and stuff, it was, you know, I started small, and then I naturally, organically moved to want more.
Yes.
Right? So once I got a taste of how nice it was,
yeah.
It wasn't a chore, and it grew, and I wanted to know more, and I wanted to go deeper, and I wanted to sit longer. But, you know, for a long time, it just started, you know, 10 minutes or so, and that seemed forever.
Yeah.
And now half an hour doesn't seem like enough.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
Right? And instead of taking time away, which people always like, oh, I don't have enough time. It actually helped my mind focus so much that my mind wasn't so scattered. Mm. And I felt like I had all this time and things were more organized. And the way that I chose, and that's the big thing, is the way I chose to spend my energy was different and with more mindfulness and more awareness because of what you were talking about before, which was it makes you more present and aware of where you are. So that was really helpful. So for anybody starting a meditation practice, I think we're agreeing on the same thing. Start small and let it build naturally because you'll just want to know more.
100%. I totally agree. I would also share and add to that, Anna Margaret, that I would apply it to your everyday. So, you know, we were taught to have a very disciplined sitting practice, and that is ideal, don't get me wrong, that is absolutely the ultimate goal, but for those of us who are just starting off, doing it in your office or doing it in your kitchen or doing it in, you know, even as you're bathing, you know, incorporate it into your day in such a way that you just increase your mindfulness. Now, a distinction, by the way, I also wanted to make is that in the Himalayan tradition, the form of meditation that we are taught and that we learn is what we call pratyahara, sense removal, right? In the mindfulness practice, it incorporates all of your senses. So in order, and it all leads, by the way, to the same place, but it's just, do you go within and then gain your awareness, or do you go and embrace and accept and surrender all of yours to your surroundings through your senses and then gain your awareness? It's just a different methodology. So I would encourage people who need to incorporate this into their daily lives to explore mindfulness as an option so that they don't have to remove themselves necessarily because that takes a much more disciplined practice. I don't know how.
Yeah, and the irony is when you go out there and you just start to check things out, it does draw you to a place inside of quiet. And sometimes starting from a place of quiet is a little bit too scary, or it's, you know, to get to that place. But you're right. They both take you to the same. It's like, you know, are we empty or are we full? And we're both.
Yes.
One thing that you both mentioned that I think is also worth underscoring, that it's not something that's in the head or even something that removes you from everyday life, you know, that you're enmeshed in it one way or another when you come out of it or during the practice of it. But also, I think you both mentioned how good it feels. It does really feel good. It isn't like a torture, right?
Yeah. Well,
there are torturous methods.
There are torturous methods,
and we've experienced them. but there is a statistic around if you meditate for 20 minutes, it's the equivalent of something like 3 hours worth of sleep. So that's how relaxed your body and your brain, because it's about your brain frequency. Actually reducing to a much calmer state in a way that allows you to really relax at all levels. And so that's where a lot of the energy you're energized from is that, you know, deeply relaxed state.
You know, I'll tell you, I'll tell another story, and it probably reflects on like where I am in the practice, which isn't very far at all. It's just like little baby steps. But at one point, it was probably around the time that I was doing teacher training, and as that culminated, I fell off the meditation wagon. Probably for about 3 weeks, maybe almost a month. Yeah, it was bad.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I'm getting bad looks. But the thing is, it kept weighing on me that I wasn't doing it. I just felt continually out of sorts. And then the one day that I first came back to it, it felt like there was just something so fundamental that had been missing from those 3 weeks. It really does weave itself. Like Anna Margaret was suggesting, you start to do everything different. You come out of it and you You look around to see what needs folding.
I love it.
Those
kinds of things. No, it's a way to organize.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Your world.
Yes, and it's you're so right, Vicente, and Anna Margaret and I have chatted a lot about this, where the practice no longer exists outside of you. It becomes part of your. It's like breathing. You find that you crave it, and you miss it when you go back to it. Yeah. And no judgment. We we all fall off, and we all get back on. But we are reminded of how great we feel, and its repercussions in our life when we do get back into it. And that's the practice. It's just that's what. All yoga is all about.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take another little break, and we'll be back in a little bit with the rest of our discussion of yoga and meditation and its application to the workplace.
You're listening to the hottest college radio station out right now on 99.5 The Mix.
Yogami, a podcast from Miami about yoga and stuff.
Okay, and so we're back with Fred Tan and the Yogami podcast, and so we've been talking about meditation at work and gotten pretty specific in terms of what people can get out of it as well as what companies can get out of it, which is a substantial amount when you're talking large companies that are trying to save in basic healthcare costs and get create conditions under which people can be more productive. So I think we have time to get a little bit of a taste of what Fred is talking about, and he's going to guide us through a little bit of a practice. Anna Margaret, why don't you tell us a little bit of, like, frame this for us?
Well, I thought Fred could give us just some tips of, you know, if you're sitting at your desk, something simple that you could do, that someone could do. Let's say they have to walk into a meeting, or they have a deadline, or they're just, like, really stressed at work, or like you mentioned, when you're sitting at your desk before your day starts, what do you do? So maybe just for a few minutes you can take us, just verbally, like, and I'm already sitting up taller and sitting up straight, because even listening to Fred, even when he talked about breathing, my belly was like, oh yeah, remember, expand and contract. So, you know, maybe something simple like that that people could just, you know, just connect with and start to practice.
Sure. A practice that I do very frequently that is very good for people who are just starting to meditate is what we were just talking about before, which is deep breathing. Mm-hmm. And so what I would suggest anybody who is preparing to go into a conference room for a meeting or to start their day is just allocate 5 minutes or maybe even 3 minutes, whatever time you may have, and just settle yourself into your own chair or the chair that you're going to take in your meeting. Posture is important, as Anna Margaret said, so if you have your feet planted squarely on the ground and your legs sitting in a chair kind of hip distance apart, it's good for your balance. If you want, you can use your armchair to support your back so that your back, your neck, and your head should be in alignment. And if you can, just slightly tilt your neck and your chin forward so that you can breathe freely. That's all the purpose of the alignment. And many people feel uncomfortable closing their eyes. If they close their eyes, that's great. If you want to just soften your gaze and look at something on your desk, but you want to, again, bring your awareness inward. So the practice that I do is what I call breath awareness, and it's simply visualizing silently the movement of your breath in through your nostrils, up through the space between your eyebrow, and then down. Envision it, the breath going all the way down to your stomach, filling your diaphragm, let's say. And then seeing as you exhale, the breath leave your body the same way it entered. If you just sat still and then breathed very slowly and yet comfortably and fluidly in, visualizing the breath moving down to your stomach, and then gently as you exhale, feeling the breath go up to the space between the eyebrow and then out through the nostril again. You don't want to breathe through your mouth, if at all possible. You'd like to, if possible, breathe just through your nostrils. So if you repeat that using, let's say, a count of two or three, so it's inhale, one, two, three, visualizing the breath moving in, and then exhale, one, two, three. Just do that just for a couple of minutes. And whenever you feel your mind going towards the day or discomfort in your body, just gently bring it back to focusing on the breath. An awareness of the breath. And that way it trains the mind over time to focus just on the breath. And it removes your what we call monkey mind from the process and the practice. A simple exercise like that to start the day, you'll find really rejuvenates you, grounds you. Not only will it relax your body because you're oxygenating your body and your organs, but then you'll find that over time your focus will get better and better and easier and easier.
Wow, that brief little exercise already, I feel mm-hmm. different. It's
yeah,
amazing.
It really is powerful, and you see why we wanted to have Fred as a guest.
I was going to say, he could read the ingredients off a package.
Yes.
And I would be in a meditative state.
Yes.
I've been known to put people to sleep.
That's another show.
That's another show. Exactly.
Fred, along those lines, if somebody's getting interested in using meditation in their place of work, incorporating it into their work life, or even generally into their lives, are there any particular resources that you would point them to?
That's a great question. If anybody is interested, let's say, in a live teacher in studio, I first would recommend seeking out Anna Margaret, and this is truly. But daily offering yoga, if they seek out Anna Margaret for a personal session, that's the first resource that I would absolutely recommend. The second is that there are YouTube resources. Explore the YouTube for mindfulness, and you'll find a lot of great short practices. Mm-hmm. And that people find that if they follow a guided practice in the comfort of their own home, in the safety of their home, they tend to be more interested and less self-conscious about it. So mm-hmm. that's another resource I would recommend. There is a website by the name of emindful.com. And eMindful was created by a bunch of New York ex-investment bankers that were longtime meditators, and they were retired. And They came out of meditation, and in fact, they work very closely with the CEO of Aetna, and brought a lot of the programs to his employees. So eMindful.com is a great resource. It's mostly for corporations, but it has a whole mindfulness for individuals program as well. So those are three resources that I think would be very useful for people.
Awesome.
So we've talked about very specific things that people can get out of a mindfulness or a meditation practice at work, things like increased productivity, focus, that sort of stuff. But can you leave us maybe with some general comments beyond that about meditation in general? Sure. In particular, I know that the tradition that you're both into is, that you're both part of, is very life affirming.
Yeah.
And really seeks to empower people generally. Can you sort of give us that more,
yes,
maybe deeper context for our practice?
Sure, absolutely. So what people will find when they get to a certain state of their practice is that they are not their minds. And the Himalayan tradition and many other living traditions like the Himalayan tradition will show us experientially, we will palpably feel and witness what it is like to witness our conditioned behaviors, our proclivities, our limiting beliefs, all of a sudden patterns that we never knew of our own behavior or our own thought processes or conditioned thinking. We ourselves challenge them, at least we witness them. And that's, by the way, where transformation occurs. When we can witness how we're about to react to something and then decide and choose to, Anna Margaret's words before, choose how we are going to, how we choose to react or respond rather to that situation while still being immersed in the present moment. So mm-hmm. on one level, the Himalayan tradition in a more esoteric sense teaches us self-mastery over our own minds and how we can, living fully grounded and part of the world, work with our minds in a way that optimizes at our potential as human beings. That's one aspect of it. Then there is the spiritual aspect that really allows us to explore even further who we are as human beings and as spiritual beings. So as you know, many sages have said, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we're spiritual beings having a human experience. And that's really the essence of the Himalayan tradition, is really reconnecting with our spiritual essence and knowing that's who we are.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end a show than with those kinds of comments. Fred, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, pleasure. Fred. Thank you, Vicente.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Anna Margaret. And we'll be back, oh, I don't know.
In a couple weeks.
Sooner or later. Yes, I love that. Más o menos.
Más o menos.
This is Miami, after all.
That's commitment.
Yes, we will be here. Yes. Just give us a break on the time. Yeah. Fred, once again, thank you so very much. I think this has been an excellent
discussion.
Thank you
for having me. Yeah.